One of the things I love about the letter of James is that it offers a Christianity for realists. Back home in Northern Ireland, when someone became a Christian, people would say that they had been converted. For me, that was when I was 15, give or take a few months. That was 38 years ago. What I'm discovering is that conversion isn't a fast track to heaven. Conversion doesn't pluck you off the road of life. It does, however, change how you travel on that road of life. This early part of James's letter is focused on the fact that that road, sometimes is tough. Even when you know where your destination is, when you know where your true home is. The American musician Jason Isbell sings about winding roads and ditches that seem to have a magnetic pull to them. He sings this: "It just gets so hard to keep between the ditches when the roads wind the way they do." I love the fact that Isbell belongs to a band called the Drive-By Truckers. Great name for a band. If Isbell talks about winding roads and ditches, James talks about the same things but calls them trials and temptations. And those two often go together. If trials are challenging external experiences, then temptations are challenging internal experiences. One is pressure from the outside, one is pressure from the inside. He's already been talking about trials, and we were looking at that last week as we thought through verses 1 to 8. Now he's going to go on to talk about temptations in verses 12 to 18. But before he does so, he pauses to talk to the rich and the poor in the congregations that he's writing to. The gospel had thrown together into one big family people from very, very different life experiences. You had people like Philemon and Onesimus, slaves, slave masters. You had people like Lydia, a leading businesswoman in the fashion trade, rubbing shoulders with stay-at-home mums. You had Jews and Gentiles, men and women, educated and blue-collar. The gospel, the core message that transforms a human being, had thrown together people of very, very different experiences and life backgrounds. And learning to exist as this new community, united by the good news, united by Jesus, was challenging to say the least. And right now, James is addressing one particular dynamic of this new community: the rich and the poor, who are learning to be family together. So here's a question. Why, having talked about trials, does James suddenly start talking about wealth? The answer lies, I think, in the fact that wealth shapes how we experience trials. Our wealth, or lack of, can deeply influence the impact of trials. I think COVID-19 is proving that. James, in response to this dynamic, brings his readers back to this core message of the Christian faith, back to the gospel. And so we read in verse 9, "Believers in humble circumstances," in other words, believers who are poor, "ought to take pride," or in another translation, "boast in their high position. But the rich should take pride in their humiliation," or in another translation, "their low position." Are you poor? Then take pride, boast in your high position, enjoy, make the most of, live out of it. Are you wealthy? Well, actually, embrace your low position, face your humiliation. Now, that's a tough verse, so it might be worth clarifying what James is referring to here. So he uses this word position. What's he talking about? Well, he's not talking about economic position. So the poor are not to take pride in their high position. No. This is not economic position. Rather, James is talking about the position in which the gospel of Jesus has placed me. The gospel, this power to convert me, repositions me as a human being. So James is talking about my position, and it's not an economic position. It's the position that I am given because of what Jesus does in me and does for me. So position. Also, the core message of the Christian faith is going to impact different people in different ways. I wonder, is that something that you've realized? Is that the gospel is going to impact you differently than it's going to impact me? Yes, there are going to be huge similarities. Of course, we will both be forgiven. We will both be offered life in all its fullness. But the way the gospel begins to impact me, shape me, form me, really is unique to me, because of I'm going to come to the good news with unique weaknesses and unique challenges, and the gospel is going to address that in different ways and in different times. And so it's not surprising that the rich, the wealthy, will have different blind spots and temptations to the poor, and both need to see the gospel applying to them in different ways. And also, James wants us to know that whether we're lifted up by the gospel or humbled by the gospel, this is something which is actually good and well worth celebrating. So how can this be? Well, one message which our world can sell us is that wealth will make you something, will make you someone. Wealth can leave you feeling important. Wealth can give you power, a feeling of power. Wealth can make you feel safe and secure. But the gospel, in contrast, begs to differ. The gospel tells me that even the poorest, most destitute Christian is already someone. However materially lacking in life I might be, James says to me, says to poor Christians, poor believers, that they are to reflect, embrace what he calls their high position, chapter 1:9. In God's eyes, because of Jesus, I have already made it. And what James seems to be implying here is that Christians who are poor particularly need reminding of this. They've already made it. They are already someone. But they especially need to be reminded of this during times of trial. You've already made it. You've already a high position in God's eyes. The rich believers, by contrast, James says, are to take pride in their low position, to take pride in their humiliation. James is saying that for a person of wealth, the gospel can be deeply humbling. Now, why does he say that? Well, we tend to equate wealth with security. It's very easy to think that once we have enough resources squirreled away, that we're covered. That whatever life can throw at us, we have this protective cushion of our wealth. Money enables us to weather the storms. And again, you know, COVID has proven this. And so for a wealthy and successful person to become a Christian, they have to acknowledge, or the gospel faces them with the fact that before God, however rich they are materially, they are utterly bankrupt spiritually. And James seemed to be suggesting that the rich especially need to hear that message during times of trials. You see, when difficulties comes, it's easy for me as someone of wealth to think that, well, all I need is me. All I need is my bank account. And I can get through life. I can get through this tough time. But here's the danger. Here is the great danger. In fact, it's an eternal danger. Wealth makes people think that ability in the economic sphere translates into ability in the spiritual sphere. I might be strong when it comes to my bank account, and that might mean, or might make me feel that it means, that I'm also strong when it comes to spiritual things. And James's message to them is tough, but freedom giving. The gospel says to the wealthy among us, you are only a Christian because God has been generous towards you. Not because of any of your own achievements or accumulations. Spiritually, wealthy people have what they have because God has shown them grace. God has given them a spiritual handout. They've had to come to God for charity. And so the gospel both lifts me up and humbles me. Now, personally speaking, I have needed to allow the gospel to lift me up at times, to remind me that I am already someone in God's eyes. And there are times when I've needed the gospel to remind me that I am spiritually bankrupt and that I need God's mercy and grace. And I guess right now, each of us need to consider how this works out in our own lives. We need to think about our own circumstances, which of James's two categories we will predominantly fit into. Do our circumstances tend to push us to feeling a sense of shame? I'm nobody. Or do our circumstances tend us to feel a sense of self-importance? I'm somebody. And it may be that we veer between the two depending on the situation. But wherever we find ourselves, we need to take pride, boast, embrace our gospel-given position. And as we do so, we are able to stand against the tests that life throws at us. Now, James moves on to temptation. He turns his attention away from what goes on around us, trials, to what goes on within us, temptations. From trials to temptations, or to use the words of Jason Isbell, from the winding road, trials, to the ditches, temptations. For the New Testament Greek geeks out there, the word James uses for trials or tests in verse 12 is the same word translated as tempt in verses 13 to 14. Trials and temptations often go together, don't they? Trials around us can prompt all manner of temptations within us. Understanding temptation is therefore vital for ensuring that we respond in healthy ways to difficult circumstances we often find ourselves in. And so we read this, verse 13. When a person is tempted, they shouldn't say, God is tempting me. God can't be tempted by evil. And he doesn't tempt anyone. Verse 14, but each person is tempted by their own evil desires. These desires lead them on and drag them away. Verse 15, when these desires are allowed to remain, they lead to sin. And when sin is allowed to remain and grow, it leads to death. James expects temptation to be a normal feature in the Christian life. Am I a Christian? Then I'm going to experience temptation. As long as I'm on the road, as long as I'm traveling towards my destination, I am going to be tempted. I'm currently reading a book called On the Road with St. Augustine. It's by James K.A. Smith. St. Augustine is famous for his biography describing his journey as a Christian. It's called Confessions. And in it, he doesn't just describe past temptations, which he's overcome, but temptations which he's currently wrestling with. So let's have a moment of honesty. What temptations are you wrestling with at this moment in time? Is there a particular temptation that is standing out for you right now that feels more powerful than other temptations? James is addressing temptation because conversion doesn't solve temptation. If anything, becoming a Christian heightens it. Conversion sets what I have become against what I used to be. And conversion sets up this tension within me. I've entered this new life in Christ, but I still experience the reality of what it was like before I came to Christ. So we need not to be surprised by temptation, but we do need to understand it. And so what does James teach us about temptation? Well, there's a couple of really quick things before we finish. Here's the first one. James doesn't want us to blame God when we get tempted. Verse 13, when a person is tempted, they shouldn't say, God is tempting me. Don't blame God. When I'm tempted, often my reflex is to lay blame for my temptation, my weakness, elsewhere. It was the way my parents brought me up. It was my parents' failure to do X, Y, or Z. It's the culture I live in. And James even suggests that at times we will even blame God for our temptations. It was the way you made me, God. And it's really important to realize that God, according to James, is not trying to trip me up. Sin holds no attraction for God, and the last thing that he wants to do is tempt us. So the first thing about temptation, don't blame God. Second thing about temptation, God's not to blame for our temptation, but we are. Verse 14, but each person is tempted by their own evil desires. The uncomfortable truth is this, the evil desire tugging away at us is our own. We can't blame any of the things around us. It's not the fault of our parents, our peers, our circumstances, our genes, or God. According to James, we really are our own worst enemy. God's not to blame. We are. Thirdly, James wants us to take responsibility for the desires lurking in our heart. This is verse 16. Don't be deceived, my dear brothers and sisters. You see, it's self-deception that makes us so quick to blame God and so quick to excuse ourselves. That's self-deception. And you know what? We will do everything to forget just how bad we are. And the final thing that James wants to teach us about deception, temptation, is this, if we forget how bad we are, we never want to forget how good God is. Verse 7, every good and perfect gift is from God. Verse 17, this kind of gift comes down from the Father who created the heavenly lights. See, when it comes to times of trial, it's so easy to lose sight of the good things that God has given us. We can be deceived about what God is like. And so having reminded us of the evil desires that spring up within us, James now wants to draw our attention to the good gifts that come down to us from our Father. And we're going to, in the experience of temptation, forget just how good God is. And so it's so important that we continue to remind ourselves of God's goodness. At our Tuesday morning prayer time, the wonderful Derry, as we were listing all the things that we needed to ask God for, reminded us that we needed to begin by praising God for every blessing that we've received. And when we started to pray, that's what Derry did. Derry thanked God for the blessings in his life. And we've got to do that. It's a discipline. We've got to remind ourselves that God is the source of all blessing, that everything good that we've experienced this week has come to us from God. James describes God in some beautiful ways. He describes him as sovereign. He's the Father of heavenly lights. He is the Creator God. He's the one who made the stars and fixed them in place. He charts their course. He's the cosmic and glorious God for whom all things are possible, the one who reigns over every corner of the universe. And it is this Creator God who wonderfully takes an interest in us. Hear that today. The God of the universe takes a wonderful interest in you. He's sovereign. James also tells us that this God's love is dependable. Dependable. This is a God who does not change. God made the stars, but he's unlike them in a very important way. Like the heavenly lights, our own planet is constantly moving. The whole universe is a swirl of motion. And as a result, shadows never still, but continuously shifting. But God never shifts like a shadow. He's constant. His love is totally and utterly dependable. He's sovereign. He's dependable. And your God is gracious. He's the God who has given us new birth. He's converted us, saved us. We are born again. We are adopted sons and daughters of the Most High God. And James reminds us that every perfect gift comes from above, but especially this gift of new birth. It is to this that James points when reminding us that God is powerfully, dependably, and graciously good. And it's this that we need to keep in the forefront of our mind, especially as we continue along this winding road with ditches either side, as we journey towards our true home, as we journey towards our destination. We will face trials. We will face temptations. They will be part of life lived on this earth. But we have a God who's sovereign, dependable, and full of grace. And the people of God said, Amen.